This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, and that means it's time for the Week in Review, and we'll begin with stories of years of sexual harassment on Beacon Hill.
Everybody knows this has been going on. You know, I mean, I've covered politics for 20 years, and I worked at the State House for part of that time, and it was blindingly clear that it was going on Beacon Hill.
Governor Charlie Baker has ordered his staff to review sexual harassment policies.
We'll make clear in a very explicit way that none of this sort of thing will be tolerated.
And House Speaker Robert DeLeo says the legislature has a zero-tolerance stance on harassment, but he says it's also time for the legislature to take a look at its policies.
What I want to make sure is that the victims really get a sense of, that they're not going to feel any fear of bringing their story to the appropriate authorities.
And former Senate President Therese Murray, the first woman to hold that leadership position, also weighed in.
Sometimes in a particular generation, they haven't quite caught up to what the new rules are and thinks it's okay to make jokes and make comments.
Well, there's a great deal to discuss, and joining me to do so today is Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Renee, it's good to see you again.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. We're also joined by Richard Tse, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. And Richard, it's great to see you as well.
Nice to be back.
I'm going to actually start with you, Richard, because you have firsthand experience on Beacon Hill. What was your reaction when you read these stories about so many women saying that they've had such difficulty with harassment?
Well, I kind of had an interesting background in that I went into the building in 1984. I was there in the 90s, left in 2010. And I remember when I first went in, you know, you'd hear the stories. I mean, back in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, you're totally in a different time period, obviously, than we're at right now. And I guess things have become very politically correct at the State House. Everybody's careful, you know, nowadays, but I'm surprised at still how much has been sort of bubbling up over the last couple of weeks, particularly in Yvonne Abrams' columns and so forth. And maybe it's me, and I'm oblivious, but, you know, I asked a couple of my former aides, and they were like, oh, yeah, didn't you know this, and, you know, and I'm, you know. So I think that the Senate president and the Speaker of the House are both fine people, and they, you know, they obviously don't want to see that type of atmosphere in either chamber, the governor, obviously. And I think that this is happening all around the country.
Yeah.
It's a national conversation, and they need to, you know, clean up their act institutionally and be at the forefront.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you mentioned Yvonne Abraham's name, because a great tip of the hat to her for her reporting to bring all these disturbing stories to us. And then they keep coming, right? Like, I was just, someone told me recently about the fact that she had arrived one day at a meeting with a representative, and she arrived early, and because there was no one else in the room, suddenly found herself being chased around the table by the representative. I mean, and the way she was communicating to me, said it was kind of like par for the course, that it wasn't unusual at all. I mean, Renee, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I spent 8 years as a reporter at the State House, 5 for the Boston Phoenix when I was really quite young in my 20s, and then 3 for the Boston Globe. And, you know, everybody's experience is different. Mine was mostly, I was more likely to be sort of patronized or condescended to by men in power, you know, not sexually harassed, but basically, you know, not being taken seriously. That was my problem. But, you know, there is a certain culture at the State House, and I suspect at City Hall, too, let's say, as Yvonne pointed out, you know, there's a lot of long nights, there's a lot of late hours, there's a lot of drinking. And I think that, you know, it's sort of endemic. It's kind of epidemic to that culture. I think the, you know, Anita Hill brought this to light 25 years ago, or more than 25 years ago. And, you know, things haven't really changed that much. I do hope that given the sort of the power of the whole social media Me Too campaign, which I don't generally like the social media, but I do think that it elevates this, you know, concern or problem, which it is, to a higher level and could have some effects.
Well, so to that point of, you know, asking more about the culture on Beacon Hill, we did speak with Yvonne Abraham this week, again, the Globe columnist who brought all these stories to everyone's attention. And here's what she said about culture and the Massachusetts legislature.
there are legislators with a lot of power who don't really answer to anybody but the voters, and the business is built on relationships. And, you know, some women might be reading that situation as like the, you know, going to after hours events is something they need to do to network, and some of the men on Beacon Hill see it as something else.
Richard, today I want to ask you about this because, I mean, the other thing that I took that truly disturbed me from Yvonne's reporting was that basically nobody was willing to use their names because it's such a small, insular world where, I mean, this is politics, right? So relationships matter, that all these women were afraid if they spoke honestly and gave their names that it would completely deep-six their careers in Massachusetts.
No, and I totally understand it, but I do think, again, we're having a national conversation right now about sexual harassment in the workplace, and whether it's the State House, whether it's the media industry. I mean, NPR had a problem themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's in academics or film and entertainment, I think what's happening right now is a really healthy thing. And you know, any big institution has had these problems over the last few years, and probably. Maybe it's more accentuated at the State House for the reasons that you mentioned.
So you're right, and I'm glad you mentioned NPR, because we should be totally transparent about that and say that, yes, like the senior most news editor at NPR, Mike Oreskes, had to resign because of disturbing allegations around him and sexual harassment that date back decades from when he was also at the New York Times. But, I mean, my question is, you're right. We're at a moment where everyone's talking about it. So maybe people feel more empowered to say this happened to me. But what do we do to stop it? Right. Because like on Beacon Hill, and you guys know the culture of Beacon Hill, on Beacon Hill, as we heard earlier, you know, Robert DeLeo, the governor, et cetera, all saying, let's take a look at policies and training and things like that. I mean, is that enough or should more be done?
Well, I think there are some recommendations in that ad hoc women's committee that were made just recently that I think make a lot of sense. It's sort of hard to believe that members of the legislature and everybody who works at the State House doesn't have to go through mandatory harassment training. I mean, I've done that at least 10 times, I think, even in my little nonprofit I'm working for now. Every couple of years, you have to go through this training again. It's not perfect, but it does, you know, raise consciousness. So I think it's important to do. Go ahead.
Yeah, and you do have to do that in the state Senate right now. Mm-hmm. Senator Rosenberg, when he came into the presidency, implemented that, and it's a great credit to him. And I know that the speaker has pretty much said that he's going to review all of the policies on the House side. And you know what? I think the best way to prevent this from happening in the future is just to go through exactly what we're going through right now and just, you know, have, you know, sort of rip the, you know,
veil off
mm-hmm. and just move forward from here.
You know, it is possible to change culture. I mean, it's important to remember that. You know, we all remember times when everybody was smoking all the time indoors. It wasn't, you know, the idea that you would have a bar where you couldn't smoke was laughable. People, you know, pick up after their dogs now, which never happened, you know, when I was a kid growing up. There are, you know, the whole drunk driving, you know, designated driver culture has taken root in, you know, our kids' generation. And I think it's important to remember that it is possible to change, you know, even deep-seated cultural norms. And, you know, we just have to get at it.
I mean, one of the ways to do that is to get more women in the legislature,
isn't it?
That
wouldn't hurt.
Yeah. And, you know, I also want to say that as the stories trickle out, that most of what we've heard have been stories that women have. But I've also been hearing that some gay men as well have been saying that they've had some difficulties on Beacon Hill as well. So I wanted to not overlook that. But before we move away from the Massachusetts legislature, I just wanted to quickly ask you both about a piece of legislation that I didn't want us to forget about, because Massachusetts could soon become the first state to ban bump stocks. Those are those devices that you can add to a semi-automatic weapon to make it behave as much like a fully automatic weapon. And they were the devices used in Las Vegas, in the Las Vegas shooting, which was just last month. We've had some very terrible weeks, haven't we? And so Beacon Hill lawmakers have sent the legislation. They've passed it both House and Senate. They've sent it to Governor Baker, banning bump stocks and trigger cranks. And we have a little bit of tape here from State Senator Karen Spilka.
We are going after those devices, those two devices that can make guns and almost an automatic.
Yeah, and so the governor has said that he has previously expressed support for banning these devices. I just wanted to get reaction from both of you quickly on that, especially since the federal level legislation that people were talking about is gone nowhere.
Stalled, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and even the National Rifle Association, which doesn't like anything that even whispers about gun control, has said that they never intended these bump stocks to be used in this way to make automatic weapons. So, it seems a no-brainer to me to pass this legislation. There are some details about it, the way it's interpreted and this kind of thing that need to be gone through by the parliamentarians to make sure it's, it's correct, but the overall intent of the legislation, I think, is clear.
And the governor's office says that they will review the bill carefully. Yeah.
I was just going to say no-brainer, but you stole
that. All right.
And non-controversial, really.
Yeah. But apparently controversial enough that the legislation stalled on Capitol Hill at the federal level. But anyway, so let's move on to some news out of Washington this week. And one of them are some indictments coming out of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's ongoing investigation into Russian influence in the presidential election. Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign manager, and Manafort's business partner, Rick Gates, were indicted on conspiracy and tax fraud charges for things that went on before Paul Manafort joined President Trump's campaign, I should note. But Manafort's attorney, Kevin Downing, says the charges have nothing to do with Russian interference in the election.
Well, I think you all saw today that President Donald Trump was correct. There is no evidence that Mr. Manafort or the Trump campaign colluded with the Russian government.
And the president also insisted the same, that his campaign did not collude with the Russian government.
All I can tell you is this. There was no collusion. There was no nothing. It's a disgrace, frankly, that they continue.
Okay. Manafort and Gates. Go, Renee.
Oh, well, you know, I think that it's very bad news for President Trump. He can try to minimize this as much as he wants. But, you know, the grand jury is already sitting. And so and the wheels of this investigation are starting to, bite. I think the real October surprise, though, is not so much the indictments of Manafort and Gates, but the revealed guilty plea of George Papadopoulos, who is, again, the president is trying to say minor advisor to him, although there is tape with the president saying he's an excellent guy. That, I think, is the real problem for the president.
Yeah, so we should say that that George Papadopoulos did plead guilty to lying to the FBI. That's what he's pleaded on. But the things that he was lying about have to do with his actions as a campaign advisor during the campaign and his interactions with various Russians as well. So that does tie things directly to the campaign. Richard, your thoughts on that?
Well, I would just say that the indictment of Manafort happened were because of things that happened when he represented the Ukraine.
Right.
I think 7 years before. Donald Trump's name was not even mentioned in the indictment. And I think my takeaway, and I think the real problem, that the October surprise that's going to pop up here, is the fact that Paul Manafort was working hand in hand with the Podesta, Tony Podesta, who runs a lobbying campaign. And we all know that John Podesta, Tony's brother, was Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman.
But the emails.
But I think, and I'm not just, I don't want to get into a big Trump, anti-Trump thing. I think it shows how, you know, Washington is the swamp. And here you have Hillary's campaign chairman who had all these interactions and business relationships with Trump's campaign chairman. Mm-hmm. And the very day that the indictments came out against Manafort, and again, it's because of his representation of the Ukraine, Tony Podesta resigned from his company. And if you read the indictment, it mentions Company A and Company B. Company B is obviously the Podesta group, I think that has a lot to do with him resigning. And there's a lot more that's going to come out. And I think for people who look at Washington and are totally disgusted, again, this is off subject for Trump, but totally disgusted by the way things work and the role that money plays there. When this all plays out and is presented before the American people, I think they're going to be sick.
Okay. But what about George? I'm going to take you back to George Papadopoulos here, because in his guilty plea and what came out there, he basically was trying to arrange meetings with high level members of the Russian government.
He was an unpaid member of the campaign. From what I understand, he was
sitting at the table with Donald Trump. He met Donald Trump once in that photo.
But you know, the Washington Post came out, and when Donald Trump announced his advisory committee on foreign, affairs, his background and his number one, resume item was that he participated in Model UN. And the Washington Post.
This may say more about the Trump Washington, campaign
exactly,
than anything else.
The Washington Post mocked him and said that this guy's a nobody. What is he? And then all of a sudden, now we're expected to believe because of the indictment. And he obviously sounds like a very dumb person anyways.
But here's what I wonder.
Well, we're expected to believe, though, that he's a mastermind, and he's.
No, I don't think that's what we're expected to believe. Yeah. Here's what I wonder. If you obsessively read over court documents, as I am wont to do, you see that in the documents surrounding the government's motion to seal the Papadopoulos plea, the government calls Papadopoulos a proactive collaborator, a proactive something.
Proactive cooperator.
Cooperator, exactly. Yeah. Now, I've seen a lot of legal analysts saying that that means he was wearing a wire, or he may have still been wearing a wire for many months between July, the end of July when he was arrested, and October 5th when he signed that guilty plea. So, you know, he might be a low-level guy, but he had access to higher-level folks within the Trump campaign. And I think we may just be at the tip of the iceberg in terms of what Robert Mueller has.
That's right. And I think he's sending a signal that, you know, he's being very tough here. I mean, he's going after Manafort and Gates with, criminal charges, which in some cases have in the past been just civil charges, failure to register as a foreign agent. He's clearly squeezing Papadopoulos, otherwise he wouldn't have made this agreement. So I think he's sending a signal to all of Washington, to all of the anybody else who might be called before the grand jury to we're taking obstruction very seriously. We're taking lying to the grand jury or to the FBI very seriously. And, I think he's being very methodical and very tough. And I think it's going to make it very difficult, as much as the Trump administration would like to, brush this off as a flea. I think it's going to make it very difficult for them to advance their agenda on any other issue.
Yeah. So we'll see where this goes.
It's a nice segue.
I want to be able to just talk for another big story out of Washington this week before we turn to our hubbubs. And that is the GOP tax plan, the House tax plan, which was unveiled just yesterday. One quick piece of tape here. Here's how House Republicans talked about the goals that they see accomplished in this tax plan. Here's Speaker Paul Ryan.
So, yes, the focus is on middle class tax relief. The focus is on directing that tax relief to the people in the middle and the people who are trying to get there. And that is why we put our emphasis on that tax relief for those people who are in the middle, who are working paycheck to paycheck, striving to get ahead. We've got to modernize our tax code so that we can be competitive again, so that we can keep jobs in this country, so we can keep businesses in this country.
Richard, your thoughts on it? It's a $1.51 trillion plan.
If nothing else, what I think is critical for the country, it's been 30 years since they've reformed the tax.
1986, right.
Last time is this corporate tax. It's got to be more in line so the United States companies can be more competitive around the world with similar companies. Right now we're at 35%.
35%.
Canada's at 15. Ireland's at 12.5.
This bill puts it at 20 now.
Most countries are 15 around the world. And what you've had is, because of the way our tax structure has worked, is you've had all these countries divesting from the United States, buying shell companies. There's trillions of dollars sitting overseas that could be coming back here, being used to reinvest in companies in the United States and to hire people. If all of the other stuff wasn't in the bill, and it was just the corporate tax rate, that would be huge.
But it's not the only thing in the bill.
Yeah, so actually, this is a really good point, though, Rich. I think you make an excellent point, because maybe not everyone, but I think you could find a consensus around
corporate
tax.
I want to just say President Obama, the Clintons, they've recognized how every day that goes by that we're at a disadvantage, we're divesting.
Yeah, and you could find a consensus on ways to get those offshore funds repatriated to the United States. But as you're saying, it's not the only thing in the bill. The bill is 400 pages long, and it touches absolutely everybody.
That's right. I mean, there's everything in there from, you know, the estate tax to, you know, removing the prohibition against churches having, you know, who with their tax-exempt status, you know, being able to get engaged in politics. So, I mean, there are so many things wrong with this bill. It's like, it reminds me of that old joke about the food is terrible, but the portions are so small. I mean, it's like the facts of the bill are terrible, and the process of ramming it through that's going on in Washington is also terrible. So it's, you know, it's hard to know where to focus first. I love that House Speaker Ryan is talking about how the focus is on the middle class, but the numbers are on the rich, so or on corporations. And I just think that, you know, we can debate the minutiae of this, and I hope we do, actually, and that this does become a debate where we're actually looking at what's in the bill instead of just ramming it through. But I also think we shouldn't lose that big picture, which is it's $1.5 trillion. Yeah. That's so much money. That's 1,500 billions. And, you know, here we are supposedly not having the money to renew the child health insurance plan, for example, and we need to be able to find compensating cuts in other mm-hmm. children's yeah. health programs in order
but
to do
only,
that.
The only
but
way,
this bill does not require offsets.
But the only way you get the money to do that is to grow the economy. And we've gone through a period of stagnation for almost a decade right now. It is interesting that the last two quarters would have the GNP rate has been 3%. And what's going to happen is if this bill passes, particularly another good part is, I think, condensing to three tax rates.
Yeah. Plus one.
From what we have right now. and, no breaks for people over $1 million. Renee should like that. so you can't call it a tax for the rich necessarily. But, you know, but the point is, I think if this passes, the economy is going to take off and we're really going to end up, revenues are going to increase. We're going to end up growing ourselves out of the mess that we're in right now. And there are so many, you can already tell in anticipation, the stock market's at record highs, the economy's really starting to do well right now, and this will really propel us. Trump calls it rocket fuel. I do think it's going to be a big win.
There are a lot of influential policymakers in Washington who are aligned with your point of view, but I think there are several economists as well who would say, well, you know, it's debatable about whether or not massive tax cuts do lead to growth. In the Clinton years, we had tax increases, but we also had a record growth as well. So
I mean, I wish it were true what Mr. Tsai here is saying. You know, I would love to believe that, but I just don't.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I own a small business, and some of the provisions in this bill, I'm a subchapter S. It's going to allow me to buy new equipment. It's going to allow me to reinvest in my company.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are the things, and a lot of the small businesses aren't totally happy with the bill. But those are the types of things when you're making decisions, you're looking at what's coming down the road, and we're sending out a great signal if Aaron talking about this, and if it ends up passing, look out, the economy is going to go really well.
Yeah. In fact, one thing which I think a lot of small businesses would like is that the deduction for new equipment purchase
yes.
is being raised by like 10 times, right? Up
right.
to like $2 million or something.
Right.
So that's great. I mean, that stuff is good. But again, it's all together in one bill.
No,
it's going to be a messy fight.
It's called sausage making.
yeah. Look, we've made so much Week in Review sausage. We are actually out of time. So no hubbubs. Darn it. Okay. Can you save them for next time?
You bet.
Okay. Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much. And Richard Tsai, former Republican minority leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Thank you so much.
You.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.